corruption, greed, betrayal, sex. The new fictional crime novel entitled Network of Killers by author D.B. Reynolds explodes with elements of excitement. To find out more about this explosive book, please visit the author's website at www.d-b-reynolds.com. Available in print edition and Amazon, Kindle, and Barnes & Noble Nook.
Welcome to Authors First on the Artists First World Radio Network, artistsfirst.com. Questions or comments during the hour, don't send them to me. That's right. Visit the author we're interviewing during the broadcast. If you're an author or independent recorded artist, follow the links we have at artistsfirst.com to learn how you can gain ridiculous publicity on Artists First Radio. This hour, it's my privilege to introduce author Wade Hobbs, H-O-B-B-S, author of Other Life Exists, a fascinating scientific book based in science from NASA. We're going to learn all about it from Wade Hobbs this hour. So be sure to visit his website, buy the book. It's a fascinating read. You won't be disappointed. Be sure to share the content of this broadcast with all of your friends on Facebook, Twitter, and your social network sites. And now let's give a warm welcome to our guest. How do you do? Wade Hobbs.
Hi, how are you, Tony?
Other Life Exists. You're with us.
Yes.
Thank you for joining Artists First Radio. It's our privilege to introduce you to our audience worldwide. How did you stumble across our network?
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here. I found you on the web.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Boy, the web, it's changed everything about the way we communicate and learn and gather information. Is this something, a field that you dabbled in previously, or did?
I did. Yes, I've done a lot on the web. I started off in information systems, computer science, that sort of thing, back in the 80s. And I did some technical programming, and then I went into the patent field. And, of course, patents required more study of physics and electrical engineering. I did some electrical engineering at the graduate level. And around 1989, of course, NASA launched the Galileo probe, which went out to Jupiter. And it returned a wealth of data about Jupiter and its moons, and I became fascinated with this topic.
Oh, it is a fascinating topic. You know, if we would just be imagining this in the 40s and 50s, and here we are, you know, today, 2012, receiving back after a decade information that is helping frame and actually change the way we look at the universe.
Oh, that's absolutely right. In my first book, Other Life Exists, I present a statistical argument that proves that microscopic life must live in one of the moons of Jupiter. That moon is called Europa.
Wow, what a great journey that was. But I wanted to start, Wade Hobbs, at the beginning, and that's why I brought you back to the early 80s when you began to study science in earnest and become fascinating with these topics as Galileo and other probes were really beginning to collect data.
Yeah, well, you know, the Voyager back even in the late 70s and early 80s sent back data on the gas giants, and it took pictures of Europa. So many scientists, just from the little data we had from the Voyager, believed that Europa, which is this moon of Jupiter, held an internal ocean. And they drew that conclusion because of the pictures. You could look at Europa, which again is a moon of Jupiter, and you could see that it didn't have the craters that Earth's moon has. If you look at Earth's moon, you'll see a lot of craters. That's from asteroids, meteors, slamming into the moon. But Europa isn't like that. If you look at the surface of Europa, which is, again, for novices, this moon of Jupiter, it has cracks in the ice. And it has an appearance similar to the Arctic ice of Earth. You know, if you fly over the North Pole, for example, or over a lot of the Arctic Sea, you'll see these ridges in the pack ice, and that's because the ocean beneath the pack ice is shifting the ice around, and it causes cracks in the ice. Well, a lot of scientists, particularly geologists, looked at the Voyager pictures and saw that it was geologically active. Europa didn't have the craters that our moon has. So many of them concluded that it had an internal ocean. But Galileo actually provided even more data, and it solidified the conclusion that Europa has this massive ocean beneath the ice. First of all, when Europa orbits Jupiter, Jupiter's massive gravity causes Europa's shape to change, and that's because the gravity causes tidal shifting. It pulls the water, just as the moon that goes around our planet causes tides, so too with Europa as it orbits Jupiter. The tidal shifting actually bulges the ice a bit, so there's a difference in shape as it orbits Jupiter.
Now this was actual data collected that we can measure and quantify scientifically. This is not guesswork. Well, there may be some element of that, but guesswork with a high level of mathematical accuracy.
Oh, no, it's not guesswork. There's a third piece to the puzzle, and this was provided by Dr. Margaret Kibbleson of the Galileo probe team. She published a press release back in 2000 that analyzed the data that Galileo brought back. Well, she analyzed the magnetic data of Europa and Jupiter. As Europa orbits around Jupiter, its magnetic fields change, and the magnetic fields of Jupiter's change. And Galileo was actually able to measure these magnetic fields. Now, to make a long story short, you can draw an inference about the interior of Europa based on the behavior of these magnetic fields, because salt water, relative to ice, is a relatively good conductor of electricity. You see, ice does not conduct electricity. But if it's salt water...
And so her article, her research from that data demonstrates that there is an ocean, a body of water, a salt water, or some substance mm-hmm. that would conduct electricity.
Yeah, that's right. It's salt water. And, you know, they've put the pieces of the puzzle together. First of all, the cracks in the ice, and then the slight changes in shape, and also the changes in the magnetic fields, and they've concluded that it must hold this vast ocean of salt water.
Fascinating. You know, the distance of Jupiter and the moon Europa from the sun creates this frigid environment.
That's right, yes. It's Europa is believed to have a surface of ice, and it's believed to be about 60 or 65 miles thick. Now, that's an estimate. But beneath that ice, the ocean is estimated to be over twice as big as all the salt water on Earth. So Earth is no longer the largest source of salt water in the solar system. It's no longer the known largest source of salt water. That's Europa. It's a massive, massive body of water.
And, of course, 40, 50 years ago, the technology was limited as terms of the depth that we could go even here on Earth, and yet we found life.
Oh, that's true.
And so it's now that we understand that in the deepest caverns of the Earth, near volcanic openings and so forth, that life can be created and grow and live and diversify.
That's true.
In total darkness.
True. In very deep waters in the ocean, where there's little or no sunlight, they find this microscopic or microbial life, and they call them extremophiles because they live in extreme environments. It's really phenomenal. But you mentioned how tough bacterial or microscopic life is. Well, they've really come up with some tremendous findings. For example, Apollo 12 brought back a camera from the moon. And this camera was placed on the moon by the Surveyor mission. It was a robotic device, and it had been there for about 2.5 years. Well, they brought it back in sterile conditions, and they analyzed it, and they found that it had bacteria inside the camera. So the conclusion is that bacteria from Earth went to the moon and survived for 2.5 years inside the camera in the vacuum of space, and then we found it when we brought it back. Some have questioned this conclusion because they think it may have been, they think that the experiment may have been contaminated here on Earth. But I support the conclusion that the life survived in the camera because of later findings. In the 1980s, NASA conducted an experiment called the Long Duration Exposure Facility. Now, what happened to this? It's simple. They put bacteria in some glucose spores, some glucose, and they put it out in space, and they exposed it to the vacuum of space. So this bacteria was living just in a thin coating of glucose, which is sugar. And they also put some in salt crystals. They left it out there for over 5 years, brought it back, and 80% of the spores were still living.
Wow.
So that gives you an idea of how tough bacteria is.
And how marvelously created the universe is, that it is actually now we think of it more of a life-creating monstrosity. I mean, with suns and systems giving birth all the time, and the possibility of life through that energy. In other words, the old way of thinking scientifically was, well, the universe is dead. There's nothing. We're just a fluke, an accident. There can't be any other life in the universe.
Yes, well, that's still one argument. That's one school of thought.
We're talking about life at any level.
That's right. Right. Now, the Fermi paradox is that, if there's life out there, why haven't we found it, we can now safely conclude that, as I prove in my book, Other Life Exists, that microscopic life does, in fact, live in the waters of Europa. And here's one other bit of evidence that proves how tough life is. Just recently, in 2007, the European Space Agency sent out this little microscopic life called a tardigrade, and I've got a picture of it in Other Life Exists. It looks like a little water bear. You can actually see it. And they exposed that to space. No protection whatsoever against the vacuum of space. And it survived, or many of them, a high percentage, survived for 10 days of exposure to space. They brought it back, and a high percentage of them still survived. So that just gives you an idea how resilient bacterial life really is.
Well, when something large impacts a living planet like Earth, isn't it possible that some living matter can escape our gravity and be projected into space and travel a billion years before finally landing in an infertile ground?
That's quite possible.
So Earth itself may have been cause for creating or passing life forward.
That's a possibility, Tony. Now, in my book, I focus specifically on the presence of microscopic life in the waters of Europa, and then I expand the argument to two other moons of Jupiter, which are Ganymede and Callisto, and then a fourth moon, which is a moon of Saturn, and it's called Enceladus, but I'll get to that one in a minute. But there's a very strong statistical argument that microscopic life must live in the waters of Europa. Well, first of all, in every body of salt water that we've ever tested here on Earth, we've found microscopic life. Now, Europa holds a body of salt water that is over twice as big as all the salt water on Earth. So, to entertain the idea, if we may for a minute, that there's a body of salt water out there that's over twice as big as Earth, and it's lifeless, is to really entertain an incredible idea.
Let me digress a little more. We understand scientifically from the data collected from our probes certain physics about Europa, Jupiter, the moons, and so forth. From that, understanding the physics, the dynamics of gravity, weight, pressure, size, depth, all of those and all of that technical data, all of that scientific data, then gives us an environment. And once we understand an environment, then we can begin to suppose what it would take to live in that environment. And we can do that by understanding how organisms live in very difficult environments here on Earth. And so, therefore, if we understand that organism and how it can survive on Earth in that extreme environment, then, and now we understand the physics of what's happening with gravity, weights, pressures in that world, we could envision what type of organisms could survive and live.
That's right along the lines of the arguments that I make. That's right.
And so I want our audience to understand that I think for many it's science fiction. Well, it's from your mind, you understand? But if we ground it in chemistry, when we understand physics, that certain rules apply on Earth that would apply elsewhere in the universe, then once we can define that parameter, we can understand what type of life or what it would take for life to survive there.
That's exactly right. And you know, Maxwell, who is the father of electromagnetics, said that the true logic of this world is in the calculus of probabilities, or the calculating of probabilities.
Yes, so, that's right. For instance, we began to believe that there might be other Earths. But it wasn't until we could define the Doppler effect of our planet that would help us find other planets that have similar composition and movement.
And there's an amazing amount of research on that topic. That's fascinating stuff.
It really is. And for those in our audience that grew up with Star Trek or Star Wars or science fiction, of the possibilities of life and what it may entail in the universe, I think that there's sort of a merger coming here of collected data that is making science fiction more like science fact.
Well, we can build the arguments now because we have sufficient data, and we can start with something simple. For example, if you take a cubic foot of salt water in Earth's ocean, and you compare that to a cubic foot of salt water in Europa, which is Jupiter's moon, you'll find that there are a lot of similarities. It's H2O with sodium in both places. So if you consider it from the viewpoint of microscopic life, swimming around in Earth's ocean, that microscopic life sees the same thing as microscopic life in the salt waters of Europa. It sees H2O and sodium.
Were you able to spend a little time with the thought processes of Stephen Hawking?
Sure. I've read a lot of his stuff.
Because hasn't he pretty well said we have to now know and understand there is life elsewhere in the universe?
I think he believes in life elsewhere, too. Yes, you're right. And, here in the United States, Francis Drake, of course, had his equation concerning intelligent life. Of course, Carl Sagan did a lot of research in that area as well. Professor Hawking, as I recall, concludes that there's a very high probability that life exists somewhere because the universe is so big.
And it's so old. We're looking back in time so many billions of years. These may have been living organisms that are now have already seen their life, like the dinosaur here on Earth.
Uh-huh.
And have already gone through their levels of extinction, of having a tremendous opportunity for life for many hundred millions of years or billions of years. Now their life has come to an end, and all we see are 60-foot deep or 60-mile oceans of solid ice.
Well, it's as you say, the universe is a vast place. It's over 12 billion light years big. If you look back at the Big Bang, that happened over 12 billion light years ago. And
give or take a few.
Yeah, exactly.
So, a lot can happen given the right energy, environment, situation, and with the preponderance of matter that exists. And, of course, all matter that exists has always existed from the very beginning. Isn't that right?
Well, you make a good point. Let's go back to the time of the creation of our planet.
So nothing is lost.
The Planetary Nebula.
Nothing is lost. I mean, we're all in a vacuum somewhere in some shape, some gas, some form, some chemical. Nothing is ever. It may change in usefulness as we view it, but in terms of the elements, they're all there.
That's right. And as I mentioned in my new book, Known, which is available at expertsubjects.com, the Earth and Jupiter came from the same planetary nebula, as did all the planets and all their moons. The Earth is about 4.5 billion years old, and all the elements that comprise Jupiter and Earth came from a common source, and that is the planetary nebula. And I look at this idea in Known, and I explain away our traditional notion. And our traditional notion is that Jupiter and its moons are different worlds. They're just completely separate worlds. Well, in fact, they're not so different. As I say, they come from the same planetary nebula, first of all. And secondly, we've had interplanetary transfer of materials from Mars. We found Martian meteorites here on Earth. We've found transfer of materials from other bodies in the solar system. For example, we've got moon meteorites. We've got meteorites that came from the asteroid Vesta. Now, we've only been looking around for them for, what, a few hundred years, maybe? So we don't have any specific examples of a transfer of material from Europa or Jupiter that we can look to. But if you simulate on a computer the orbits of Jupiter and Earth over, 4.5 billion years, and you simulate collisions with asteroids, then you'll find that there's a high probability of some sort of transfer of materials. So the two worlds, in that sense, aren't completely different. They're not entirely separate. And a third point is that our probes are bringing the two worlds together. You know, human interaction here. The Galileo probe flew around Europa countless times and explored the other moons of Jupiter. Cassini, which is the European Space Agency joint project with NASA and the Italian Space Agency, actually landed on Titan. And so, you know, our
And these were projects that weren't chosen accidentally, okay?
Oh, no.
It takes decades not only to create the technology and make it work and test it, the survivability and condense the weight and everything. It's more than that. Planning, what direction, trajectory. Around, I mean, these were locations in our universe that were chosen very carefully by our scientists to learn about our universe and looking at those environments.
Oh, that's right. It's really finesse work in terms of the engineering. You've got the creme de la creme of engineers and scientists putting these things together. They actually flew the Galileo probe after it had, you know, completed its mission. They flew it into Jupiter. So our worlds really aren't entirely different these days.
And we're collecting stardust through our probes, creating panels that allow us to capture particle sizes that are invisible to our eye, but collected in these cells, membranes, and then we're able to analyze that data. Do you expect that we'll see life coming from that research?
As I mentioned in my new book, Known, which is an e-book available at expertsubjects.com, the Stardust mission from NASA actually collected samples from a comet, brought them back here to Earth, and they found amino acids. They actually found the basic building blocks of life in the ice of that comet.
How tremendous.
Isn't it?
And so there you go. All of this new data just is opening our minds to the possibilities that generations ago never. It would be science fiction. We just didn't
right.
have the scientific
exactly
collect
right.
data to even surmise that this would be possible in our universe, and yet there it is.
Yes, and in that sense, science fiction is becoming science. But I want to be sure that your audience understands that my two books are limited in focus just to microscopic life, because I think it's critical to establish in the public's mind that microscopic life can be proven scientifically.
Yes.
This is not a matter of fiction anymore.
That's right. Thank you, Wade Hobbs. That's correct. These are not fictional books in the sense that it's a sci-fi book. These are, but you've written them, and you've written this book, Other Life Exists, in a very readable, enjoyable, intelligent fashion. And not only that, the details are there. So if you wanted to do additional research above and beyond what you have in other life exists, that's possible. Because you are referencing certain historical and scientific journals and documents.
Yes, thank you, Tony. I appreciate that, and I hope all of your readers will take a look at it and enjoy it, because I wrote it, as you say, for a general audience.
You had fun doing it,
it's a lot of fun.
This has been a burning passion for you for decades.
That's right.
And yet it hasn't been until the more recent decade that you've had all of the or enough sufficient information to really make this book a reality. And I thank you for writing it and for having that vision, that drive to do it. Astrology, there are certain disciplines that you may dedicate your entire life in the exploration, discovery, and then someone else, find it. But you're not. I mean, it's a bittersweet when that happens. But nonetheless, the joy that the pursuit was worthwhile.
Oh yeah. Well, it's exciting that we're living in times when we can actually know that microscopic life actually exists. As I point out in Known, which is again the ebook at expertsethics.com, the Greeks, about 3,000 years ago, believed that some type of life must live beyond Earth.
They had that right.
Yeah, there's a gentleman named David Darling, Dr. David Darling, who's firmly with Cray Computer, who has revived a lot of the Greek ideas. And he's written on this topic as well.
This is a topic, Wade, that there is a tendency to become so scientific, so steeped in the sciences that the ordinary person would not be interested.
And
that you see that in the technical journals and so forth, because
are very dry,
right? And of course, those are for the serious doctorates, those who are looking for particular details. And your book, your approach is to draw the audience in and allow the mind to see the possibilities.
Yeah, and I also have some fun. For example, I point out that there's a basic problem here when you find life, and that is if it's life if it's microscopic life that you find out there, and it's similar to microscopic life that's here on Earth. You don't want to walk into the president's office after they spent billions of dollars on it and say, "Gee, Mr. President, I'm sorry, but we're not really sure if we actually found this life out in space or whether we took it with us."
Yeah.
They're not gonna be real happy with that.
Well, it happens, right? But yeah. I think that it didn't happen. I think that we have known, and we're collecting information on a regular that tells us that life has the ability of creating itself in the universe outside of our own environment.
That's right, and we can actually confirm it now. Back in 2005, the Cassini spacecraft collected information on a moon of Saturn called Enceladus. And that's the moon that actually spews out ice from its internal ocean. Like Europa, which is Jupiter's moon, Enceladus, too, has internal water. And we know because they flew their Cassini space probe through these plumes of ice. And they actually captured some of the ice. They analyzed it. And they found, first of all, that it's got sodium in it. It's got sodium levels that are comparable to the sodium levels in Earth's oceans. And that was recently disclosed by Dr. Carolyn Porco of the Cassini mission.
Well, and, what was it like for you trying to get the information you were looking for? First of all, you have to know sort of where to look, and then you have to have some kind of access or permission to look, and then you have to have the ability to decipher and understand what you're looking at.
Well, that's right. A lot of this, again, goes back to the web. It's freely available on the web, and that's another really good thing about our age is that we exchange information like this, and the pace of change, as you've noted, the pace of change is just blistering at times.
You're right. I mean, if you are a doctorate student, if you're or working in a particular field, it doesn't exist until it's online. It's invisible. Everything goes there. You're not going to do your work without placing it there because you want it to be seen and you want to be recognized for your work and you want others to be able to build on your work.
That's right. And what Enceladus really does for us is it gives us a very easy way of confirming the existence of microscopic life, because you can just fly a probe through the ice, as Dr. McKay of NASA has noted. You just fly the probe through the ice, and you capture some samples of the ice. You've got to put a microscope on the probe, and then you look in the ice for either the frozen microscopic life, or there's a possibility that it may still be surviving in the ice. Some microscopic life exists in the ice of Antarctica here on Earth. But in any case, what Enceladus offers us is a relatively easy way of physically confirming that microscopic life lives there. Whereas if you go to Europa, which is the moon of Jupiter, you've got, 65 miles of ice to get through, unless it's on the surface. But to actually get to the water, there's a very deep, there's a lot of ice to go through.
And we love water because, that's where we live. I imagine there could be life without water, some other chemical exchange different than our own water based life, but for our purposes, water is the key element that we look for in the universe to know that the possibility for life could exist as we know it.
That's quite right, and it's the critical step, and this is really the meat of the argument, the proof. This is the way we know that microscopic life must live up in Europa, and it's a statistical conclusion. And as I point out, another life exists. We have 122 seas here on Earth. It depends on how you count them, but I count them as 122. In every sea here on Earth, of course it has salt water, you find microscopic life. Now, can we equate the initial conditions between salt water here on Earth and salt water on Europa? If we can, then Europa is just the 123rd body of salt water to examine. And the reason I say that we can equate initial conditions is that the microscopic life, again, in either place, sees a very similar environment. And secondly, I've discarded this notion that they are different worlds, Jupiter and Earth. They're not really different worlds. And so applying that, I formulate a statistic that there's at least a 122 out of 123 probability that life must exist, and that comes out to 99.2%. That's a 99.2 probability in favor of life. Now, this is a little formal, but the reason I use it is because it's a scientific proof. So in statistics, typically you have a couple of theories, and you test those theories, and you're able to predict future outcomes. And if the probability is above 95%, then you accept the theory that has that probability. Well, in our case, there's a 99.2 percent probability that microscopic life lives in the salt waters of Europa. So we accept the theory that microscopic life lives there, and we reject the theory that it's lifeless. And that's the proof.
And then, even on that level, we have the food chain.
Oh, yeah.
So
you're going... Yeah, you're going beyond. That's the really interesting question.
Yes,
these days.
Because just to be, and now you're food for something else. Up the food, up the chain we go, and the more complex the organism becomes. So there could be vastly complicated organisms from that foundation, because it is a food source.
That's exactly right, and that really, really gets into some interesting questions as to what type of life beyond microscopic life lives there.
Well, and in an environment where so many hours, the change in gravity, the pool of, or the shift of weight, or heat dynamic, all of those dynamics are at work creating a life that can be sustained under those conditions. So, therefore, those organisms would be structured in a way that, that when the gravity changes, they elongate and survive, or collapse and survive, or can withstand pressures or in, or temperatures that it has and survive.
Oh, countless possibilities exist as to what forms of life live in the waters of Europa.
Well, it's mind-opening. And
oh, it certainly is.
And and that's where I want our audience to be. Have your minds opened to the tremendous possibilities and the energy, the power, the vastness of the universe and what's happening out there, and to really think critically and realistically about the technical details that are coming in, the images, the information that we're collecting from our probes. I hope that our government and the world governments can pool together enough resources to continue that type of research.
Oh, wouldn't that be excellent? Yeah. If we could turn this into an age of exploration, it would
well,
be a wonderful thing.
They're privatizing the space industry. Perhaps some entrepreneur or intellectual will say, well, hey, in 10 years I can be here. And then I can collect what I want that's unique there, and 10 more years bring it back here. Well, that's just 20 years, and I'll have something really unique, wouldn't I?
Well,
so if I understand the conditions that exist out there in the universe, and I understand the chemical makeup, that perhaps there's a mechanism through probes of collecting what we need and bringing it back.
Either bringing it back, or it may, in fact, be cheaper just to put a microscope on a space probe like a Cassini, fly it out to Enceladus, fly it through the ice, capture the samples, and then analyze it in the microscope.
Yeah, don't even bring it back.
Radio the data back, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, unless we need that element. I was thinking of an element, perhaps, that could be utilized for energy, or who knows what.
Still would be fascinating to have samples, just like we got samples in the Stardust mission from the comet. Of course, you know, eventually, I'm sure they'll probably bring back some samples, because that would be fascinating.
It would, and you know, the audience. I'll digress. Tony Kay in the studio. Thank you for joining us, Wade Hobbs. I think he and I could go on for hours on this topic. Other Life Exists by Wade Hobbs. Simply follow the link we've provided at artistfirst.com, and you'll be able to buy your own copy of the book, publishamerica.com, or look it up on your search engine. Be sure to tell other science buffs, people that you know interested in this topic, about the book on your social network sites, Twitter and Facebook and so forth, because this is a good read, quality information, well-researched, and something that Wade Hobbs, very proud of. And you have a second book available as an e-book. You mentioned twice earlier.
That's right.
Remind our audience again about the about that
well,
knowing.
That's known.
That's, oh, known.
Known as in what is known about the universe, K-N-O-W-N. And that's available at expertsubjects.com. Or you can just Google my name, Wade Hobbs, with the title of either book, Known or Other Life Exists. That should take you there.
What fun. You did this as a passion. You know, I,
oh, yeah.
Authors are I've interviewed just, I don't know how many, a lot. But the point is, write what you know, write what you love, write what you have a mm-hmm. passion about.
Oh, yeah.
And so this is a topic that you have been in love with, that you have thought about, that you have researched, and it's a big commitment. I mean, it takes a lot of time to become a master of a topic and stay on top of new data constantly coming in. Do you envision a revision or an addition, perhaps, to Other Life Exists in the future or a sequel?
Yes, as more data becomes available and I find new angles on the existing data. Sure, I'll be coming out with more books. This is exciting because it's the first time, to my knowledge, that we conclude that microscopic life lives in a specific place and actually have some scientific proof for it. And I compare it to a statistical conclusion about the weather. You can look back to the weather data for the last 100 years, and you can find that 100% of the time, the weather in Florida during June exceeds 80 degrees. And so you can predict, obviously, that the weather in Florida this June will exceed 80 degrees. You've got a probability that approaches 100%. It's a similar situation with Europa. It's an analogous situation.
And the physics involved in our sun and the chemistry involved in our planets are known elemental characteristics of our own planet and the universe. So we do have some basic physics and science, chemistry behind our own understanding of the universe and the sun and the effect of radiation and solar storms. And of course, now we see that happening elsewhere in the solar system on another planet, a large storm, a system. We can understand what's happening there. And of course, on a moon and its distance, proximity from the planet, the gravitational pull and changes, and then our sun, that distance, the expected temperature, the amount, and then the way that our planets go around the sun. In the distance, some of them travel in cold and then back to heat again.
That's right. We routinely apply gravity, of course, and of course NASA scientists apply the laws of electromagnetics. They did that when they analyzed the magnetic fields of Jupiter and Europa. They also apply the laws of chemistry all the time. Whenever they're trying to figure out the chemistry of a distant star or a planet, for example, they use a spectroscope, and that analyzes the laws of chemistry. Also, too, with the rules of biology, there's this heuristic that they've used, and that is where there's water, there's life. It's not as hard and fast as gravity, because there are some exceptions in terms of ice. But it is a hard and it's a strong heuristic with regard to salt water, because it applies every time in the salt water that we've explored. So just as you wouldn't abandon the law of gravity or the laws of chemistry, you wouldn't want to abandon this heuristic from biology, where there's water, there's life.
What fun you're having. Did you ever think that at one point you would be writing a serious book about these topics? Did you imagine that you would be collecting your thoughts in this detail? How did that happen? Did you fall out of bed and hit your head and say, okay, it's time for Wade to write a book? I don't think so. How did this happen?
No, well, it's as you mentioned. There are so many good authors out there, like Stephen Hawking. Of course, I read Carl Sagan, Professor Drake's famous equation. And I kept reading it, and I'm a professional writer. I wrote about it a bit. I wrote some short articles. Then one day, I was looking at the data, and I realized, hey, you know, I can formulate a meaningful statistic in a thorough, analytical, scientific way and prove that microscopic life must live in the waters of not only Europa, but also Enceladus, and the other two moons of Jupiter that have saltwater bodies. That's Callisto and Ganymede. Those two moons, too, have internal oceans.
Thank you for your research, for putting together in such an enjoyable and succinct fashion, for not, I should thank you for leaving room for our audience to have an imagination and to think about the possibilities of what can happen under those conditions. Wade Hobbs, we appreciate your support of the arts on Artists First World Radio Network. Thank you for being our guest, Tony Kay, in the studio. Is there an email website or somewhere else our audience should be familiar with, Wade?
Well, Tony, you can find my first book, which is the original book, Other Life Exists, at publishamerica.com. Or you can find Known, which is my most recent book, at expertsubjects.com, or through a Google search, Wade Hobbs, and then the title of either book, Known or Other Life Exists. Or if you want to send me an email, that'll be fine. I'm at W_Hobbs, H-O-B-B-S, @mail.com, mail.com. And Tony, I just want to say that it's been a pleasure speaking with you tonight, and I'm really honored to be on your show.
Thanks for being our guest, Wade.